This is a closed circuit feed, not for broadcast. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I speak with author Dave Marsh. His biography of rock star Bruce Springsteen, Glory Days, examines the rise and popularity of Springsteen's music and his influence on American culture. Bill James talks about another cornerstone of American culture, baseball. James has made a career out of analyzing baseball statistics, looking for what he calls the deeper truths of the game. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz makes his case for Elliot Carter as one of the greatest modern composers. And our language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg says if you've never really understood the Pledge of Allegiance, you're not alone. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. With me now on Fresh Air is writer Dave Marsh. He's the author of Born to Run, a biography that covers the early career of rock star Bruce Springsteen. It became the top-selling rock bio in publishing history. Marsh's new book, Glory Days, examines Springsteen's career since 1980. Marsh sees Springsteen's music as representing the triumph of conviction over trendiness. Here's the song that made Springsteen famous, performed in the 1985 world tour that made him into a megastar. Born to Run from Springsteen's album Live, 1975 to 85. Since 1974, my guest Dave Marsh has both followed Springsteen's career and contributed to it. It was he who first took Rolling Stone critic John Landau to see Springsteen play in a Boston bar. Landau later became Springsteen's manager, and Marsh has remained a close friend of Springsteen's. Marsh is also the editor of the Rolling Stone Record Guide. He now publishes a monthly newsletter titled Rock and Roll Confidential that examines the political, social, and economic implications of popular music. Dave Marsh, welcome to Fresh Air.
Nice to be here.
You seem to see Springsteen not only as a great performer, but as almost a savior of rock music. What do you think rock music needs to be saved from?
Well, you know, one of the things I try to do in this new book is, Glory Days, is back off a little bit from the idea of the messianic part of savior. And just to get into the idea that what we're all trying to do is bail ourselves out of the deepest crises of our lives. Rock and roll gets trapped in a bunch of trash, in being a vehicle just for selling beer or something. What I think Bruce tried to do was save himself from that anguish of having his best ideas and thoughts converted into songs that were then converted into beer commercials. And what I think rock and roll needs is more of that kind of conversion, it needs conversion in that sense. And for myself, I guess the fear has always been, what would you do without it, and what are you going to do with it?
It's
a double-edged sword. Because to me, it was like my culture.
Well, let me quote something that you. I'm going to quote something that you say in your first book. You wrote, "Rock saved my life; it also broke my heart."
Well, it seemed like a pure thing to me, and I guess I was naive, but it did seem like a pure thing to me. It seemed like there were these singers. They got in the studio, they sang these songs, and they spoke from the bottom of their heart. And I'm thinking about songs like, I guess the great example for right now, because it was a hit again last year, is that Benny King song, "Stand by Me."
Yeah.
You know, when the night is dark, and just. That whole idea of, like, when you're most alone, something that will come and stand by your side and not let you down. For Bruce, it was a song like Roy Orbison's Only the Lonely Know the Way I Feel Tonight. And I think Bruce Springsteen is a person who writes those songs. But at a certain point, rock and roll did break my heart because it became clear that it was a business. And it was a business in the most kind of cynical way. Now, like I said, that's my fault as much as it's fault. And I guess the best way to protect yourself and save yourself from that is to grow up and adopt a more mature attitude about it. But until Born in the USA, I really don't think that any pop star had done a very complete job of that. John Lennon tried and came close. Elvis failed miserably, and Elvis was everybody's icon. You know, Mick Jagger just got old and cynical. Bob Dylan kind of walked a neat path and then got lost on it. Bruce Springsteen made it to the highest heights that I think any serious rock performer has made. And at the very moment of his greatest success, reached down and touched a community that he was supposed to be completely isolated from. And one of the great things when we were doing the last interview we did for the book was in January. One of the great things was he explained all this to me, not in terms of what he was able to do for other people, but what that connection had done to rescue him from the fate of isolation that somebody like Elvis had to experience.
Yeah, he's very aware of the traps that megastars fall into, and you make a lot of comparisons between him and Elvis, and fame more or less killed Elvis Presley.
I think it did, you know, not only because, I mean, there are people who make an argument that may have some legitimacy that Elvis's over-medication was a result of him being quite sick. But if that was the case, then somebody wasn't communicating very well with somebody else about what his physical condition was. So one way or the other, the isolation, the being placed on a pedestal, is what made him no longer alive at 43. And that's I don't know if people out who aren't big rock and roll fans really would understand what a tragedy that is, what it means for a sharecropper's son from Tupelo, Mississippi, to have reached into so many lives. And maybe somebody who's not a rock fan doesn't believe. Well, I know that from the cut of my hair to the mere fact that I can stand in front of a microphone and speak, I owe Elvis Presley. I owed him. And I know that Bruce Springsteen feels that. And I know that there are enormous numbers of people who feel that. And that somehow behind all that, there was a bigger idea blossoming than just the pink Cadillac that he sang about.
Even though Springsteen has been aware of the price of fame, didn't hype and publicity almost kill his career in the beginning?
Twice.
I remember, yeah, 1975, there were the simultaneous covers
even
of Time
that,
and Newsweek.
In 1972, when he made his first record, and he'd been discovered by John Hammond, who discovered everybody from Bessie Smith to Aretha Franklin, Bob Dylan, Billie Holiday, Benny Goodman, and John Hammond had discovered Bob Dylan. And so they promoted Springsteen as the new Dylan. Now, there have been 50 people, I bet you, hyped as the new Dylan since the old Dylan became successful. I should say the real Dylan became successful. Bruce Springsteen's the only person whose career survived it. And then in 1975, he made the album Born to Run, and that is a classic rock and roll riff. It's a classic rock and roll song, from the lyric, the music, the whole business. On the other hand, that doesn't necessarily mean that it was going to be a mega-selling record. It was not trendy in any way. And when that hype didn't work, a lot of people figured he was finished again. And one of the things that my first book, Born to Run, was about was how does someone solve this problem and why didn't he fade away and disappear? An answer that's steeped more in the qualitative than the quantitative. In fact, his next album sold measurably less than Born to Run hit, Darkness on the Edge of Town. And the album after that, it's called The River, sold only a little more than Born to Run. But what was really going on then was that Bruce had forced the marketing mechanisms of his record company to pull back. And because he was afraid of another bout of this overexposure, which probably would have killed him. And it wound up with him being the most idolized rock star with a big concert audience and not so much awareness outside of the narrow world of the rock concert cult.
Dave Marsh is my guest. He's a rock critic who is the author of the new book, Glory Days, Bruce Springsteen in the 80s. Now, Springsteen really made his reputation with teenage anthems about frustration, sexual frustration about wanting to get out of the town you were born into. And then as he got older...
I think it's class rage is another way to look
at it. Sure, yeah. And as he got older, those lyrics didn't seem quite as relevant. I mean, because he didn't need the sexual frustration. He wasn't a teenager anymore.
He told me an interesting thing. He said that the Born to Run album, which is encapsulated for me in one line at the end of the song Thunder Road, was the first song on the record he sings. This is a town full of losers, and I'm pulling out of here to win. He said, well, that was my story. The Born to Run album was his story, personally. And he said, after that was over, he looked around and he said, well, what about everybody else? And at that point, the teenage anthem stopped. And the work begins to mature. The vision begins to darken and deepen. And you begin to get a broader spectrum of humanity. Still with some of those teenage reference points. There's still a lot of cars and a lot of women referred to as girls. Until you get to... But the answer is still, you know, he's still got this inadequate answer, because the inadequate answer is to hold your guitar up in the air and hit it real hard and make a loud and joyful noise. When he made the River album, which sold 2 million copies, which is a very, very large number of records, what they call double platinum, and he did an enormously successful concert tour, and for the first time he played Europe and in a really large scale and was real successful there. And he came back and he toured the United States again, and he was a huge act. And he was surrounded by adulation, and he had a crew who are really, the people who work with him are the most skillful technicians in rock and roll. Not necessarily the best paid, although they make a lot of money, but there's a team spirit there. There's a band that's one of the better bands in rock, and that has a real familial feeling. When that tour was over, he went home. He wasn't married. He had a girlfriend. He broke up with her. He lived in a rented house, and he was alone. And through all of that, he had not found the thing he was looking for, because he was not, you know, rock and roll is always presented as this rebellion, question of rebellion. And in fact, that's only, it only could be half the story, because every rebel is looking for to reconcile himself and join a community and find a better society to build. And I believe that when Bruce Springsteen sat down in his bedroom in 1982 and to make a little cassette demo of songs for his next album, which wound up being the album Nebraska, that he was feeling just at the bottom of a pit of utter desolation and fear, and that the fear and desolation is exactly what we were talking about with Elvis Presley, that he had been cast out, and he had missed his mark. And here was the most successful guy, and he was alone. And not being alone is a good thing. You know, any writer has to like to be alone. But being lonely is an awful thing. I can't think of anything worse. Certainly, the Nebraska album was often interpreted, and I think correctly, as a response to the Reagan years, when men and women were turned against one another in vicious and cruel ways, that the competition became a really, really sick thing. But it was also the product of this personal, I think, failure.
Well, I want to play an excerpt of one of the songs from Nebraska. And you were talking about how at some point he realized he didn't just have to keep retelling his own story from a teenage perspective. He could start telling other people's stories, too, in lyrics. And I think that's part of what he was
doing
on this record.
Right. And this is a song about a man at the end of his tether who is and isn't the guy who's singing it.
This is State Trooper from the Nebraska album by Bruce Springsteen, and this was recorded, what, just in his basement?
In his bedroom.
His bedroom.
And in fact, I'm not sure if this is one of the songs, but if you listen, you may hear the chair creaking as he rocks out, because he's just sitting with an acoustic guitar in a chair.
Let's give it a listen. This is Bruce Springsteen from the Nebraska album.
New Jersey Turnpike. I don't know where the night neath the refineries glow, out where the great black rivers pour. License registration, I ain't got none, but I got a clear conscience about the things that I. Mr. State Trooper, please don't stop me.
That's an excerpt of State Trooper from the Bruce Springsteen Nebraska album. And my guest is Dave Marsh, the author of a new biography of Springsteen called Glory Days. I really love the sound of that. There's something very kind of scary and on the
spooky
edge about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting that they released the album like it was. I mean, he'd considered doing it with a band,
right? Well, they just had
this
little cassette, and they tried to do it with a band. And what happened was that Bruce just felt it lost the atmosphere. And it did, and I think one of the reasons it lost the atmosphere is if you're playing with a band, you don't have that feeling of stark isolation that's in that music. And what that music's about is not the chords, which are pretty simple and basic.
Was there any kind of turning point for him after the album was released? It's not one of his best-selling records, but it's a really personal statement.
Well, what had happened was they recorded almost all of the Born in the USA album at the same time, and he insisted on releasing this record. And then he and a friend of his, Matty D'Elia, who owns a motorcycle shop in North Jersey, drove to California. Got to California. Bruce got out of the car, went into the house he had out there, and couldn't even sit down. Really, I need to go home. He wanted to drive straight back, which is not what he did. He sat down and tried to figure out why he felt so wretched. And out of that began to come some songs that were about a little bit different group of things. First song that came up was the song My Hometown.
I want to talk about the Born in the USA album and play a couple of things from it, but we're going to take a short break first.
Sure.
My guest is Dave Marsh, and we're talking about the subject of his new book, Glory Days. It's about Bruce Springsteen in the 1980s. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air, and my guest is Dave Marsh. He's the author of Glory Days, which is a companion to his earlier biography of rock star Bruce Springsteen. The first book was called Born to Run. We were just talking about Born in the USA, which that's his biggest seller, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Sold 18 million copies worldwide, 12 million in the United States, had 7 top 10 singles, all that stuff. You know, it's like roughly speaking, by a single artist, it's probably the biggest album ever made by a single artist, except for Thriller by Michael Jackson, of course.
You tell a story in your book about how most of the songs were written and already recorded.
Right. Well, they did 70 songs.
Yeah, that's right.
They selected the 10 for the Nebraska album, and then they selected 11 for the Born in the USA album, which was called Born in the USA because that song just asserted itself as the theme of the album immediately, which those of you who heard it will understand immediately. But And the way that they did that was they wanted songs that fit together and told people Bruce's vision of the world in this period. John Landau, his manager, and he had a discussion while they were mixing the record, which is just placing the songs in the right sounds in the right perspective. And John said, well, you know, Bruce, he said, I don't think we're done. I think we need one more song. And he said, it ought to be a single. It ought to be our first single. And what it ought to do is it ought to tell people where you're at right now. And Bruce, this was pretty strong words coming from a manager-producer. And Bruce responded equally strongly by saying that since he had written 70 songs, maybe John Landau would like to try writing one. John said, well, you know, I can't do that, but I think I got a right to speak my mind. And this is very indicative of the creative process when these guys make a record. Not the way everybody else does, but when these guys do, there's this argument that goes on. And as Bruce said, when it works, nobody wins and nobody loses. Just the truth comes out. Well, they went into the studio and mixed that evening, and without rancor, the argument was over, and Bruce went back to his hotel room where he was staying cooped up, feeling fairly miserable and locked up, picked up his guitar and began to sing a song that he had been thinking about, a little melody he'd been thinking about, and some words he had kind of prepared, and he put them together for the first time, and he sang, I get up in the morning. And he thought to himself, well, I don't get up in the morning. What do I do? He said, well, I get up in the evening. And how do I feel about this? Well, just tired and bored with myself. And then he kind of got through the first verse of the song. And he said, then it was as though his heart spoke through his mouth without passing through his brain. And he sang the chorus of the song, which is, this gun's for hire, even if we're just dancing in the dark, which is about just itching for action, which is actually another line in the song. And basically came out with a song that when you hear it, there's a certain exuberance and joy to it. But if you really listen to the lyrics of this song, and it's the biggest hit single he ever had, he gave John Landau exactly what he wanted. But he also gave him not what he was feeling in this period of time, but at that moment, I want out of this. But also, the only way out of it is to go deeper in. And came up with what for me is, with the exception of the track Born in the USA, I guess the most exciting piece of music he'd ever done. Out of sheer frustration and anger and confusion and dire necessity.
It's a great record. Why don't we hear some of it?
I think it is, yeah.
This is Dancing in the Dark. Bruce Springsteen singing Dancing in the Dark. There's a great line that I don't think we got to yet, that I want to change my clothes, my hair, my face.
Well, that, you know, one of the things I love about that line is that it harks back to how you felt when you were 16. When you're 16...
You don't give up feeling that way when you get older.
Well, exactly. But I mean, when that is the definition of how you feel when you're an adolescent. And at the same time, I bet you, Bruce is 37 now, so am I. And I bet you there are a lot of people in all the ages in between listening to the show who know exactly what we mean. You know, I mean, I got up this morning and I'm on a book tour, so I'm groggy and I didn't even shave. And, you know, I mean, my turn when I get back to the hotel, you know, it won't work, but you got to keep trying. But what you can change is maybe you can help change the face of the world.
You know, I have to tell you, I felt betrayed by his rock video of that song, which was directed by Brian De Palma.
A lot of us did.
He's, for listeners who haven't seen it, he's singing this song about frustration, looking really happy and healthy and smiling, and he dances with an actress who's planted in the audience.
Don't blame Brian De Palma. Some pains in the book about this, because I like Brian. I think he's talented. Even though he cuts his own throat a lot. This was not his fault. The thing is that Bruce wrote this song out of a feeling of terrible isolation, and what you hear when you hear that record is the joy of the music followed by its negation in the lyrics and the vocal of just anguish. And what he did when he sang it in the video was he smiled all the way through, and he had just had his teeth fixed. So the smile looked like ultra bright. That was the mistake, was that he contradicted the emotion of the song in his performance. But, on the other hand, you don't feel the same way when you sing in this song and there are 20,000 people who love you in the room.
To me, though, it's just the inherent problem of rock videos, that the mood of the video frequently has nothing to do with the mood you feel when you hear the record. And then it's inalterably changed for you because you see the video going by instead of this mood you had in your mind.
I find myself ignoring video more and more,
right, okay,
and having this problem less and less.
When the album that's from came out, Born in the USA, everyone seemed to want to appropriate it for their needs. Like, people on the left said, okay, this is a really strong anti-war statement that Bruce is making.
Well, the song Born in the USA is what we're talking about, and that's a song about a Vietnam veteran who gets sent over to Vietnam. I don't know if people know that this happened a lot. It happened to a lot of kids in my hometown where you'd get busted for car theft or something, and they said, well, you can go to jail or you can go in the service.
And
then he comes home and he gets trashed. You know, he has no job and he has nothing, just like a Vietnam veteran.
Now, a lot of people interpreted
George Will tried to expropriate it. Mm-hmm. Ronald Reagan tried to expropriate it. Walter Mondale did, in a different way Bill Bradley did. So Bruce was really shot by both sides.
How did he react to
well,
that?
Well, he reacted. Bruce is, you know, there's a Reaganite quality to Bruce in a funny way in terms of him as a media manipulator. He has a great way of turning every negative into a positive. And he insists on making affirmative statements. He did not, what he didn't do, which I think was smart, was go head-to-head with Reagan and become just another rock star screaming at the president. What he did instead was say to himself, I believe, something along these lines. I have been asked by both Mondale and Reagan to make a choice, to choose a side. Whose side am I on? And he was smart enough to say, well, I am on the side not of the Democrats or the Republicans. I'm on the side of a third party composed of the homeless, the hungry, the unemployed, the dispossessed, the, in general, the Vietnam veteran. And what he did was, in all of his shows after Reagan's speech, because Reagan's speech was the key thing, because obviously he would be closer somehow to Mondale than to Reagan, by as much as Mondale differed from Reagan, which isn't much. And in every show after that, when he went into the town, he had one of the people who worked on his staff, who happens to be my wife, Barbara Carr, go in or call ahead, find community groups. Often people worked with hungry or unemployed people or homeless people. Those were the three areas, the most common. But he did some citizens' rights kind of groups. And he would meet, Barbara gathered literature. He would meet with these people for half an hour right before the show, go on, do the first hour of his show, then sing the song My Hometown, prefaced by an introduction in which he talked about, in your hometown, this is going on, these are the people to cure. And that was a way of affirming what he was for rather than attacking what he was against. And to me, it was strategically, number one, it was a brilliant piece of media manipulation. And number two, it answered the question on everybody's lips. Well, what does he think about this Reagan thing without getting him into some silly contretemps with the president, which you can't win?
Yeah. You know, a couple of things I want to ask you, but I wonder if you think he's at another crisis now. We're running short on time, so I guess I'll have to get
well,
to give him this quickly.
Well, I don't
think
but, he is. I think he's like Walter Payton when you're just a couple steps past the secondary. They might turn around and trip him up, but I bet they don't.
But here's the thing. I mean, he's still like very New Jersey, right? Doesn't he still have a house in New Jersey? But you know, his wife is California actress and model.
No,
and
she's from Oregon, but you know what? She loves New Jersey. Uh-huh. This is very important because the answer to the worry that I hear in your voice and see in your face, and I hear out there all the time when I'm talking about this, is, you know, they're going to build a life for themselves, and somehow they're going to write and create things about it. And you know what I think? I think we're going to like a lot of it, and we're not going to like some of it. But somehow the dialogue between Bruce Springsteen and his audience, which is his first true love, is going to go on. And I think he got over. He's a grown-up making music now, and there's never been one of those before in rock and roll, and so I'm along for the ride.
Well, that leads me to one more thing, which is that you've been grown up for a lot of years now. Does rock and roll still mean the same thing to you now that you have, you know, kids about to go to college?
Listen to my voice when I talk about that. I got a kid who's going to go to college in the fall who loves you too, and if she probably had her druthers, would spend the summer following him around, and I will discourage her from doing that. But I sure am sorry to be on a book tour and miss going and seeing her smiling face when she comes home from the show or going with her. But, yeah, it still means the same thing to me. And you know, I can go – now I got 30 years to go back and – look at, and I got 30 years to look forward to, and that's a nice thing.
One last thing. You're good friends with Bruce Springsteen. Does he swear you to secrecy about his private life on these tours? Because I know he's very private.
I feel like I'm walking a thin line all the time, not because he swears me to secrecy, but because I really would like to honor his privacy, which he needs and earns by being such a great guy in public.
Dave Marsh, I want to thank you very much for talking
thank you,
with
Carrie.
Us. Rock critic Dave Marsh is the author of the new book, Glory Days, Bruce Springsteen in the 1980s. This is Fresh Air. On tomorrow's edition of Fresh Air, I'll speak with Tipper Gore. She's led efforts to require cautionary labeling on rock albums with sexually explicit lyrics. Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funds come from NPR member stations and the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. This is a closed circuit feed, not for broadcast. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, baseball writer Bill James talks about finding beauty in the box scores. Our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says music lovers aren't paying enough attention to composer Elliot Carter. Language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg translates the Star Spangled Banner and the Pledge of Allegiance into plain English. And we'll have the latest news from National Public Radio in Washington. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Time for the news. This is Fresh Air, and we're going to re-examine the music of Elliot Carter. At one time, Elliot Carter was generally hailed as the greatest American classical composer of our time. And our classic music critic, Lloyd Schwartz, still thinks so. But Lloyd says with the current popularity of minimalism, Carter may be getting slighted. Lloyd has a review for us of a recent Carter recording.
I've been combing through the new releases of contemporary music and keep going back to a record that came out on Nonesuch a year ago that didn't get the attention it deserved. It contained the first recorded performances of two recent Elliot Carter pieces, The Triple Duo and In Sleep in Thunder, his setting of six poems by Robert Lowell. It's a shocking comment on the state of contemporary music to realize that these works by our major living composer, I might as well go out on that limb, took so long to be released. 4 years for the Triple Duo, 5 for the Lowell settings. They're marvelous and sometimes difficult works. Carter, now 78 years old, has long since abandoned any conventional idea of melody and has become more interested in, well, character. Each instrument or group of instruments plays a part in the musical drama. They talk or they argue, sometimes all at the same time. They proceed at different speeds and in different rhythms, and there are often passages of the most aching lyricism. For me, the parts that keep Carter at the top of the greatest living composer charts. The Triple Duo is Carter's keystone comedy, a Rube Goldberg machine in which every turn of a cog triggers some unexpected but inevitable counterreaction. As the title suggests, there are three pairings, a glittering toy shop of instruments you either stroke, violin and cello, strike, piano and percussion, or blow into, flute or piccolo, and clarinet or bass clarinet. At one point, the pair might be as erotically harmonious as the piano and marimba you virtually can't tell apart, or as hilariously contradictory as the squeaky piccolo playing with the groaning bass clarinet, or as disorienting as the slow strings working against the fast winds. The opening gambit, a slapstick triple play, sets the whole piece in motion. Piano to clarinet to flute to snare drum, bang, the banana peel. Here are a couple of minutes from this opening. Thank you. performers of Elliot Carter's triple duo are the wonderful British ensemble The Fires of London, to whom Carter dedicated the score. It isn't ever likely to be livelier or more dazzlingly played. I wish I could be as enthusiastic about the performance of In Sleep and Thunder, which is a more difficult and demanding piece to begin with. The main problem is that it, too, is done by a British group, the London Sinfonietta, with tenor Martin Hill, conducted by the British composer Oliver Newson. It's almost grotesque to hear Hill, the proper Englishman, in the voice of Robert Lowell, singing stiffly about the modern Orpheus, with his murderous sons dancing with grateful gaiety round the cookout. These knotty, satirical, and moving poems need a singer who can capture Lowell's peculiarly American idiom. The players, however, get it right. In this delicious passage from the second poem, try to ignore the tenor, the solo trumpet, both bluesy and stentorian, mimics a failed Wagnerian soprano who is vocalizing across the yard from Lowell. In the process, Carter gives us a portrait of Lowell himself, foolish, pathetic, heroic, and like nothing else you've ever heard.
Listening to Elliot Carter's In Sleep, In Thunder, our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz is a poet and classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He teaches English and creative writing at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
The 1987 baseball season has been underway for about 1 month now, and that's already long enough to create a small mountain of data for baseball analyst Bill James. James sifts through baseball statistics, often creating his own formulas to use in place of traditional measures such as batting averages and runs batted in. He publishes his findings and his personal observations in his annual book, The Bill James Baseball Abstract. James has been called obsessed with statistics, but he says they're just a tool he uses to better understand the game.
Baseball people have all these things that they say approximately 9 million times a year. Players' peak is from 28 to 32. The players today don't spend as long in the minor leagues as they used to. All these things they say over and over and over again without ever stopping to check them out. So it's my particular niche in life to stop and check them out.
So most of the time, do the statistics you come up with support the general wisdom of the day?
Sometimes they do. The general rule is that the wisdom of the day is always overstated. Whatever it is that people think they know, it always turns out to be a little less emphatically true. A lot of them are just plain nonsense.
What's a general accepted wisdom that you've proved to be nonsense?
Well, in this year's book, I took up the statement that the players of today lack the refined skills because they don't spend as long in the minor leagues. And I looked at how long they spend in the minor leagues today as opposed to 1980 and 1970 and 1960 and 1940, and I found that they spend just as long in the minor leagues as they ever did. The average number of games played in the minor leagues before a player reaches the majors was about 450 in 1940, and it's about 450 now. It really hasn't changed over time. So what it is as you get older, the perception of time changes, and that causes people to think something has changed when it really hasn't.
Why do statistics work so well in baseball better than they do in other sports? People aren't as interested in statistics in basketball and football as they are in baseball.
Because the game is so orderly. It's the only game in which the players take turns. It's the only game in which the players stop. The action stops at particular points marked off at the field. The player goes to first base or second base. He doesn't stop 40 feet beyond first base because that's as far as he can get like he would in football. The game is so orderly that it's easy to make a record of, and that makes record keeping and statistics easy.
You seem to see a certain poetry in the statistics of baseball.
Quite certainly, yes. People think that I'm just saying this, but it's really true that the way in which baseball statistics are understood is as a type of language, that when a hitter hits 300, you don't think about 30% or 30.0%. What you think, I mean, the word 300 means something. The word 40 in the home run column means power. The word or the number 50 in the stolen base column means speed and a particular degree of speed. It doesn't mean 50 of something. Nobody, if you see 50 in the stolen base column, you don't think about 50 eggs or 50 baskets of cauliflower or 50 anything else. It just means speed. So the way in which people interpret stats is as baseball stats, is as a kind of language, and they're very capable of literature and very capable of poetry.
Your interest in history and in statistics have led you to write about players who are actually pretty obscure. You've been writing about players who many people have never heard of.
Yeah, well, baseball history, as it is written by a lot of people, tends to focus a great deal on Joe DiMaggio and Willie Mays. And I think it's equally fun to focus on Jumbo Brown and Garland Bruxton and people of that nature, yeah.
And who are these guys and why are they interesting?
Jumbo Brown was interesting because he was the biggest man ever. I think his official weight was something like 290. It was like 6'2 and 290, which made him the heaviest player ever to play Major League Baseball.
It is pretty heavy for a baseball player, for any right. athlete, yeah. When did you start keeping track of baseball statistics?
When I was 11 years old in 1960.
And when did you start keeping up with baseball?
About the same time, 1960 and 1959.
Did you think that when you got older that your interest in baseball wouldn't be so great anymore? Because I think that's what a lot of people expect. You know, then you kind of you grow up and then you become interested in another field and you settle in and so on. Watch a game on Sunday.
I suppose that happens to a lot of people. But there are an awful lot of real hardcore baseball fanatics in the country, which is why I make a living.
I can't help but think that you are finding some larger truth in the game of baseball.
Well, baseball reflects a larger truth, yes. Baseball is essentially nothing, and thus anything that happens in life can be seen more clearly in baseball and can be accepted more clearly in baseball, which is why it is so important to society. The baseball is always expected to clean up its act before anything else is. Racism, which is tolerated in society, is not tolerated in baseball. Drug use, which is tolerated in society, is not tolerated in baseball, because baseball is nothing, and therefore your view of it is so much clearer than is your view of life, which is complicated with everything. Does that make any sense?
Well, I think so, but I've always thought that's one of the reasons why we don't want baseball players to be on drugs or whatever, is because they're always held up as national heroes and symbols of what it means to be American.
That's right. They are heroes.
Uh-huh.
Athletes are heroes. That's why they get paid $1 million a year. It's exactly what they are.
Are they heroes to you? You're looking at the game from a different perspective than hero worshippers do, and I'm trying to figure out what kind of relationship you actually have with the athletes.
Well, I have almost no relationship with the athletes. It's not my job. But the study of heroes is not hero worship. I mean, one can write about heroes without worshiping them.
Your work is so highly esteemed, though, that I understand that a lot of players are asking you to consult with them when their contracts come up. I wonder if you ever have any ethical questions about that, about using all the information that you've compiled as a kind of observer and using that to help make a case for someone, getting a higher salary.
Yeah, it does create potential problems, yes. I have no problem at all with baseball players getting higher salaries. The New York Yankees this year will generate income of, $40 to $50 million in all likelihood. No one has ever been able to give me a reason why George Steinbrenner should just be allowed to keep all the money. I mean, that doesn't make any sense at all to me. I think the players should get the money or get a fair share of it, and I have no problem with that at all. There are, however, potential problems with both writing about someone and helping to represent them in salary negotiations.
What problems does it create for you?
Well, my reviews of players in the abstract are not always kind, and I realized 2 years ago that the players I had been the hardest on were those players that I was, whose agents were friends of mine and people that I worked with, and thus people that I potentially helped to represent. There's a shortstop in Oakland named Alfredo Griffin, who is the favorite client of the Hendricks brothers, whom I worked with for years. My reviews of Alfredo were just tremendously harsh. The same is true of Enos Cabell, who was represented by the Rich Group, who I also represent. All of the players that I had been really hard on were players that I potentially helped to represent. And I realized that probably on some level, without being aware of it, I was compensating. I was making sure that I wasn't favoring these players by being perhaps harsher than was necessary.
When you watch a baseball game, what do you do? Are you taking notes as the game proceeds?
I have several different modes in which to watch a game. I used to scribble notes furiously, but since I have a baby daughter, I generally am keeping one eye on the daughter and one eye on the baseball game, so I shift to a more casual mode, I suppose.
Have you ever gotten into arguments with any of your fellow baseball fans who all resent the emphasis on an empirical analysis of the game, on the game broken down into numbers?
Arguing about baseball is what I do for a living. So, in a sense, yes. I don't know. A lot of people are interested in following baseball. Baseball is something which exists to be enjoyed. And it can, whatever your particular bent is, can be adapted to baseball. If what you're interested in is drinking beer, you can go to a baseball game and drink beer and soak in the game and enjoy it on that level. If what you're interested in is cute guys, then there are women who go to baseball game because they think the guys are cute. Whatever your baseball is, essentially nothing, and for that reason, anything can be adapted to it. If, however, the approach is that you can't possibly learn anything by the numbers, then I just ignore it. I just don't respond to that, because anyone who takes that approach is an idiot, and I'm not going to argue with idiots.
Strong words from Bill James, who's the author of the Bill James Baseball Abstract and the Great American Baseball Stat Book. He spoke with us from member station KQED in San Francisco. You're listening to Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of the news on today's All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee. How will you be covering the second day of the Iran-Contra hearings?
Well, Terry, we'll be doing a number of stories. In our top story today, retired Air Force Major General Richard Secord testified that Oliver North said that President Reagan thought it was ironic that the Ayatollah's money was going to pay for the Contras. I also will be speaking with Senator Patrick Leahy, a former vice chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, about former CIA Director William Casey, who died this morning. Senator Leahy believes with Casey's death, some secrets of the Iran-Contra affair will never be revealed. And we'll also be talking to two towns that are having a friendly rivalry.
Thank you, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Before most of us could read, we could recite the Pledge of Allegiance and sing the Star-Spangled Banner. Our language commentator, Jeffrey Nunberg, wonders about whether we ever did or ever could understand our patriotic verse.
People have been complaining for years that the Star-Spangled Banner is impossible for the merely human among us to sing. What's interesting is that you never hear complaints about what should be an even more serious deficiency of the song, which is that nobody can understand what it says. By way of example, listen closely and be prepared to answer a listening comprehension question when I finish. Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous night o'er the ramparts we watched were so gallantly streaming? Now then, What is the object of the verb watch? That is, what exactly was it that Francis Scott Key was watching? The broad stripes and bright stars? The flag? Listen again. This time I'll try to simplify the wording and untangle some of the syntax. O say, can you see by the light of dawn what we hailed so proudly at the gleam of twilight, whose stripes and stars were streaming gallantly through the night over the ramparts we watched? That's right. What Key and his companion were watching was not the flag, but the ramparts, the fortified embankments around Fort McHenry. Oh, they saw the flag, all right, but that's not what the song says. Now, you can write the song out and check it at your leisure. The point is that if you're like most people, you've never really thought about any of this before. But then, why should you have? After all, we learned these words when we were about 7 or 8, and children of that age could scarcely understand them. Over and above the stilted syntax, how many kids know what a rampart is? For that matter, how often does an adult civilian have occasion to talk about ramparts in the normal course of daily life? But why have we picked on an anthem that's so obviously incomprehensible, and how come nobody seems to mind? It's not just that the Star-Spangled Banner is an embarrassingly bad poem, if you actually stop to think about it. The fact is that we generally prefer for our patriotic ditties and oaths to be obscure. I was struck by this a year or so ago when I was helping my French-born wife prepare for her citizenship test. Her immigration lawyer told her to prepare for 2 items that were absolutely sure to appear on the exam. She should be ready to define a pocket veto and to recite the Pledge of Allegiance. It was the second of these she had trouble with. Oh, she learned the words all right, but she recited it funny. She said, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands. I explained to her that she'd got it all wrong. Real Americans say it as if it were 4 long words. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands. Now, you couldn't do better than this if you deliberately set out to write an oath that children would find utterly incomprehensible. I suppose that most of us wondered idly about it when we were kids. What does this word pledge allegiance mean, and who's this guy Richard Stans? It's interesting that people should get so head up about whether the words under God should be in there or not, and yet be wholly indifferent to the fact that kids can't make heads or tails of the pledge in the first place. The fact is that our pledge and our national anthem are exactly as we want them to be. We don't really want people to ponder these words too deeply, no more than we want people to reflect too deeply about their love of country. As an Italian friend of mine once remarked, America is the only country whose citizens are patriotic without being nationalistic. And when you come to think about it, most of the really good anthems do seem to belong to countries with strong nationalistic traditions. God Save the Queen, La Marseillaise, Deutschland über alles, even Dixie, I suppose. Now, those are anthems with a sort of stirring words and rousing tunes that you can sing with nationalist fervor. For example, when you want to drown somebody else's anthem out. Well, but that sort of thing isn't really for us. What we want is a song we can mutter inattentively from the bleachers.
Our language commentator, Jeffrey Nunberg, is a consultant at the Center for the Study of Language and Information at Stanford University. Here's what's coming up on the next Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with South African writer Nadine Gordimer. Her latest novel, A Sport of Nature, looks at the uncertain role of whites in the liberation of her country's black majority. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Never Let Me Down, the new David Bowie album, and film critic Stephen Schiff discusses how TV film critics are changing his trade. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting Radio Fund. Additional support comes from NPR member stations and the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistant, Ed Doherty. Our engineer, Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. My name is Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.